Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we're going to take a look into how human consciousness can affect the material world. We've covered some of these concepts in past interviews with Carissa Conti when focusing in on the topic of interference. We discussed how to recognize manipulated reality and how it operates for various outcomes, either negative or positive. Our guest, Cynthia Sue Larson, is the author of the book Reality Shifts: When Consciousness Changes the Physical World. She describes examples of reality shifts as seeing artworks in a children's book changing to a completely different illustration, or keys falling out of the air. Does this sound more like a haunting, or are we observing byproducts of the way reality is structured on the subatomic level, or even tinier than that? This topic overlaps with the phenomenon known as the Mandela Effect, which has been described as what happens when someone has a clear memory of something that never happened in this reality. Yet it also can show how facts, artwork, and history can change. Its sudden popularity online has thousands sharing examples of where our collective memory doesn't match the official historic records. Some claim the Mandela Effect started to be noticed around the early 2000s and has been picked up and chronicled by author and paranormal investigator Fiona Broom. Fiona describes how she and a friend coined the term the Mandela Effect in referencing a conversation with a security manager at a convention she was attending. She noticed that other people remembered that Nelson Mandela's tragic death occurred in a South African prison in the 1990s. And others in the room at the time shared this memory with conviction and certainty. Well, how fluid is our reality, and what can our consciousness do to affect the material world? We dig into these topics with best-selling author Cynthia Sue Larson, who is also an intuitive life coach. She has a degree in physics, an MBA, and she's a doctor of divinity. Her website is realityshifters.com. Cynthia, welcome to Another News.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on the show.
Well, we should start by defining what a reality shift is. Could you tell listeners what that is?
Yes. Basically, a reality shift is those times that you might have noticed that things like your keys or a sock in the laundry might disappear, or it might reappear. It could transform. It might transport, or you might experience a change in time. And sometimes people also hear about dead celebrities or people that they're not that closely connected to having died and then being alive again. So all of those are examples of basically witnessing a shift in reality.
I know this is a strange question, but would you summarize some key points about the structures of reality so listeners can quickly understand how human consciousness changes the physical world?
Essentially, there's an assumption that we don't even notice is an assumption for material realism. And right now, it forms the basis of the way we study science. We look at what can be measured, and that makes sense. You don't want to have a basis for science that's founded on something you can't even measure. That would be silly. But what's happened is we've developed a bias in our sciences and therefore in our description of reality that most of us in the Western world now take to be truth. And unfortunately for the longevity of that material realistic philosophy, it's doomed. And the reason I say it's doomed is because we know that the assumptions that we've long held to be true, such as strong objectivity, causal determinism, locality, and epiphenomenalism. And these are big words, but don't worry, I'll explain in just a minute if we've got time. Basically, these are postulates about the nature of reality. They are not experimental results, but they had long been assumed to be true. As I hinted earlier, quantum physics experiments are proving those assumptions to be false. They're proving that the first assumption of material realism, that we can be strongly objective and that there can be some kind of material universe out there independent of us, is absolutely false. And we're hoping to understand things like chemistry by looking at the way chemicals interact and physics by the way physical bodies interact. But we never tend to recognize that we are the observer in that interaction, in the observation of that interaction. We don't realize that we're entangled with what we're observing. We think we can be perfect voyeurs, and that we can be, you know, perfectly objective, which is totally false. And this assumption becomes questionable when we notice how inextricably connected each of us is as an observer to any of the quantum physics experiments where we play a decisive role in determining what is being observed. And a classic experiment of this sort, it would be the double slit experiment in physics. But this is just one of the four foundational assumptions that are just completely turned over. We just flipped the table over with quantum physics, and the entire foundation of the way we used to do science is pretty much out the door. Another assumption that's been flipped, that's been overturned, would be causal determinism. We tend to think that once we understand forces causing change in a system, we can accurately predict what effects those causes will have, and we therefore expect that we can predict what would happen if we roll a marble toward a bunch of other marbles. Now, I've studied physics at UC Berkeley. I got my degree there, and we all learned in my physics program that a two-body problem can be solved relatively simply. When you start adding in more and more variables, it gets three and four-body problems, more and more marbles involved, and you add friction and so forth. Suddenly, things are so complicated that with our current computers, these old classical computers we've got now, we can't really determine exactly what's going to happen. It actually, we start noticing even with large-scale particles, there seems to be some degree of uncertainty. On the quantum level, we know for sure that there's uncertainty in play, that we live in a chaotic reality, that chaos theory is a better descriptor of nature than our very limited classical Newtonian physics theories and so forth can ever possibly convey. So when Werner Heisenberg proposed the uncertainty principle for quantum physics, he was explaining that quantum particles must be described as waves. So if you've ever heard of that wave-particle duality, this is where we're talking about it. And so when a quantum particle such as an electron is traveling in the form of a wave from one location to another, then it's moving in a very different manner than a particle. So waves are like waves on a lake where they create ripples, and if you skip pebbles on the lake when it's still, you can see the path that the stones traveled across the water, and you can see ripples interfering with one another and that sort of thing. So waves are the way that particles are moving, and therefore causal determinism is not the best way to determine locations. Instead, we're working with probabilities. And then a third assumption that's really been flipped over has to do with locality. We tend to assume that we can only have an influence on things right in front of us, that objects that exist interdependently don't need to be our concern. Actually, we're now finding that twin quantum particles can be separated across quite a good distance, and their experiments are being held in China, in Europe, all around the world, because quantum computers are being built. And we're finding that we can not only entangle these particles across great distances, but we can get instantaneous effects just doing an interaction with one particle here and influencing a particle many meters or perhaps even miles away. And this is extraordinary, but it really needs to change the way we do our science. And then the fourth assumption that I talk about in my book, Reality Shifts, has to do with assumptions of material or physical monism and epiphenomenalism. And this is basically that idea that mental phenomena are simply the epiphenomena of matter. And that's been a long-held assumption that our thoughts come about from, for example, our brain neurons. That's why billions of dollars are being spent to map the neurons of the brain. This has been a completely dead end. And if you're watching what's going on in Europe, they've basically misspent millions of dollars on this. But anyway, what we're going to find instead is that the material world is not the primary mover and shaker. Instead, the things we've considered immaterial and inconsequential would be consciousness. And quantum physics is starting to show us the weakness of these old assumptions, all four of those assumptions. So that means we're going to need to create a new science that, instead of assuming, you know, these old assumptions, would start recognizing we do have subjective interconnectedness. Each part of the universe has its own subjective perspective and is interconnected to all that is. We'll start recognizing that there are changes happening that are the equivalent of handshakes between senders and receivers, where agreements are made between the participants. We'll also notice non-local effects of consciousness. So we are definitely influencing aspects of reality in many diverse locations. And finally, we're going to start noticing there's a unification of mind and matter at the level of consciousness. That's what is changing the material world. There's an inseparability occurring there. So that was a long-winded answer, but you just hit with the very first question out the gate on a very big subject. So thank you for your listening.
I had to do that because I feel that it will preface what comes later here in the interview, especially with certain listeners who are skeptical and maybe not aware of these new revelations within quantum physics. And I wanted to ask you briefly, how long has this information been out there about quantum physics, and is it a slow influence on scientists?
Yeah, great question. Yes, indeed. The subject of quantum physics and all these topics I'm introducing here really came into human consciousness around 1900. This happened when Max Planck came up with, he coined the term quanta. But actually, even before he did that, we've had philosophers contemplating the notion of what we would now call the multiverse and parallel worlds for hundreds of years, actually. And the term multiverse was coined by American psychologist William James in 1895, which is interesting. He was writing an essay, Is Life Worth Living? And he wrote, truly, all we know of good and duty proceeds from nature, which is all plasticity and indifference, a moral multiverse, as one might call it. Now, the way he used the term is a little different than the way Hugh Everett III used it when he then moved forward in 1957. Now, here's a physicist, Hugh Everett III. He theorized that we do exist in a multiverse that consists of many worlds of parallel realities. And then more recently, in the 1990s, in the 2000s, just at the last few years, actually, physicists Yasunori Nomura and Rafael Busso, both doctors of physics working at UC Berkeley and somewhat involved in the Large Hadron Collider, both of them have proposed that the many worlds of quantum physics are in fact one and the same as the physical multiverse. And these scientists are being taken very seriously. Dr. Yasunori Nomura has co-authored papers with Alan Guth, who's one of the world's preeminent physicists, definitely no slouch. And the idea that we've got these parallel worlds, that they can't be ignored when we're looking at quantum physics, it's pretty much inescapable that we start realizing that's what is being offered to us when we look at the superposition of states that quantum particles exist in, when we look at the entanglement of these particles, and just the way that the mathematics is very clear. But to understand what's beneath the mathematics requires that our minds start thinking very differently. There's a whole different kind of logic at play with quantum physics.
I know I had a ridiculous question when I started reading about your writing about parallel universes, and I was thinking, well, why does a parallel universe need to exist at all? What's the function of it?
And right now, as we learn more about quantum biology, this is a brand new field. We're going to start seeing we'll see every field of science with the word quantum ahead of it. But right now, there's an excellent book by John Joe McFadden, and he has a co-author, a physicist also, and it's called Life on the Edge. And that book, which I described, I summarized parts of it in my new book, Quantum Jumps. But basically, they're showing that we can't really have life as we know it with regard to the kinds of mutations that occur in genetics and the way that our proteins evolve, the way that that plants photosynthesize. All of these processes absolutely rely upon quantum physics. 100%. And it was something that sounded far-fetched when scientists such as biologist John Joe McFadden first proposed these ideas. He was one of the very first on the very bleeding edge of this, and he received a lot of ridicule, such as from MIT scientist Seth Lloyd, who is well known and has written many papers, a very solid background at MIT. And Seth was one of the scientists who was hearing about these discoveries that were supposedly purportedly being made by biologists claiming that plants rely upon a quantum process to photosynthesize. And Seth Lloyd said, well, you know, this sounds absolutely ridiculous. There's a lot of laughter over at MIT. And Seth said, this is something, why don't we just put this to bed for once and for all? Let's prove it one way or the other. And there's a way we can do that. Now, Seth Lloyd is quite intelligent. He came up with a means by which the model for photosynthesis could be mathematically addressed, and it could be shown without any shadow of a doubt whether or not the plants are doing things kind of in a classical probability fashion where it's random, and then you'd end up with a system like our photovoltaic cells that are nowhere near the efficiency level of plants that are up in the 90 percentiles. So Seth and his team put together a model to track what was going on. What they found out, much to their shock and perhaps some of their horror, was that what's happening with plants photosynthesizing is something known as a quantum random walk. And if you imagine a chessboard or a checkerboard where you flip a coin, and if you've ever played checkers, then you know that you can just move your little piece just relatively close to where it starts out. So you can imagine that if you're flipping coins in a regular classical probability walk, a random walk, that you'd end up pretty much where you started. That is usually true for a classical random walk. What's different about a quantum random walk is that in the shortest number of moves, it's like the piece just makes a beeline from where it started to where it needs to go. It's like watching a checkerboard player who's just getting random flips of the coin as to whether to go left or right. It's just zooming across the board. And that's how plants apparently are ridiculously efficient. So that's a mathematical kind of an answer to the question, but what we're starting to see is increasing amounts of evidence from mathematical models that show that nature, as usual, has preceded us and appears to be making benefit of the same types of things we'd like to start seeing in our quantum computers when they come up online.
And it's also a use of the parallel universe.
Yes.
Okay.
Now that's where it gets a bit controversial, but I would definitely assert that it has to. This is where people who are saying, like, well, that doesn't make sense. There's got to be some other explanation. Hold on, let's not go so fast. It's unavoidable. We just get to a point where the philosophy of you've got to depend on these superposition of states, you've got to depend on the fact that many possible realities are concurrently coexisting and that we can move between them.
Well, I wanted to get back to the observer effect and something that you mention in your book, Reality Shifts When Consciousness Changes the Physical World. This was published in 2011, so you were way ahead of a lot of people writing about this. But getting into the observer effect, I see dialogues about this online saying, no, there's no way that a human being, by physically looking at something, will change the outcome of it. And what the scientists are referencing is something on a super micro scale, and it doesn't affect us on the macro level here. What are your thoughts on that criticism?
Okay, well, I expect that, I know that right now I've got a fringe opinion, and I know it's currently unsupported by current scientific evidence. However, having said that, I do anticipate that we will get evidence of exactly what I'm saying very soon, probably in the next decade, and we'll be seeing it first in the form of those scientists who are looking at sensory perception in humans. We've been recognizing already that the sense of smell, for example, appears to have a very strong connection to quantum sensing, that there's a quantum teleportation occurring, if you will, in nasal receptors. And so the old model of a square peg fits in a square hole for two identically shaped molecules coming into a nasal receptor, we know that's wrong. And this has been proven wrong by people who, you know, take a look to see, you know, what's going on with smell. And when we look at that, we can see clearly that there's instead of seeing that kind of sensory receptor, it appears that because if we did have that sort of square peg fits in a square hole, mm-hmm. we would see very clearly that two identical molecules would be smelling the same, but they don't. And we notice that deuterium, for example, smells different than hydrogen, that there's this very big difference. If you want to look up what I'm talking about, this is the work of Dr. Luca Turin, and he's conducted some experiments at the Fleming Institute in Greece and also in Europe, other places. But basically, this is just the beginning of what I anticipate to be a whole new field of study and a whole new line of support for the fact that humans actually do sense on the quantum level. And we've just assumed for all these years that that's not the case. And the fact that we've been able to witness and visually recognize a literal quantum jump with the human eye, I believe that's further evidence that for sure this is something that's going on, that you can actually witness. When you can witness something like that, as has been observed physically, then we've definitely reached a point in history when we're no longer able to just assume blithely. The thing I'm referencing here has to do with the way that scientists were able to observe in the laboratory that quantum particles can make a jump from one energy level to another. You might remember that in any given atomic structure, so you've got the nucleus that has the protons, neutrons, you've got electrons that are on the outside. When an electron makes a quantum jump, it's jumping from one level of energy to another. And the experiment I'm referring to now that was seen with the human eye happened in 1986. It was reported in the New York Times, and they had the headline something like, "Physicists get to see a quantum jump with their own eyes." This happened at the University of Washington. Just the fact that this could be witnessed was extraordinary. Some of the physicists who were involved in the experiment explain why it's so exciting, and they say that the atom is in one state, it moves to another. You can't picture what's in between. So you call this a quantum jump. And in quantum mechanics, you don't ask, what's the intermediate state? It passes from one to the other. And it can do that with just sort of this mysterious way. So what's going on? We don't yet know. But it does look like these quantum particles are moving from particle state to wave state, where they're not observed, and they can be visually observed with the human eye.
And the transitions are elusive sometimes for people, especially when they manifest on the macro scale.
Right. So now we're moving out of the science of it, the scientific experimental lab section, and back into real life, practical field observations that you and I and everyone listening can make. Absolutely. We absolutely can observe these kind of quantum jumps in our daily lives by recognizing, first of all, that such things are possible.
Okay, and that is a belief system, and it references the power of a belief system. And we could imprison ourselves psychologically in a belief system, but we could also free ourselves to be able to begin to recognize what a reality shift is. There are many other components that you have to be prepared for in order to recognize a reality shift, such as a good diet, physically but mentally, etc. Could you maybe go down a list what things have to occur for recognition of a reality shift?
Great, yes. That's a great point, and you're right about that. We do need to actually be in good health. You have to have had enough sleep. People might assume, and I would say incorrectly, that you would observe these things if you're hallucinating, that if you've not had enough sleep. Actually, that's not the case, because I mean, you might notice weird things if you haven't slept correctly or if you've eaten badly, but in truth, the kind of people like myself, ordinary everyday people that are witnessing these reality shifts, tend to have the greatest success when you do have enough sleep, when you've had a good diet, and when you've gotten to a place of open-mindedness regarding this entire phenomenon. That's extremely important because we often don't give credence or we don't even recognize how important our assumptions about reality are. They're extremely important. When we just open our mind a little bit to the possibility that it's that we're able to encounter a reality shift of a favor, and it could be, I would like to present also, these can be quite favorable. Some people are scared of reality changing because they might assume it could go in a wild, crazy direction. That often happens. I mean, often the first reality shifts people notice are a little bit annoying, the same way that when your pet might try to get your attention, you might be typing on the keyboard and your cat or dog lifts your arm up in the air because it wants a pet. You can think of reality shifts doing the same thing. They're annoying at first. But once you start noticing, like, oh, this is happening, then it's possible, and in fact, quite likely, that you can start experiencing more favorable shifts in reality, where you get synchronicities that are favorable and so forth. So open-mindedness and recognizing that your beliefs are malleable. They're not set in stone. And even if you think, well, I've always believed this, that's also a belief. So I'm just presenting for listeners who this may be a new concept. You absolutely can change your beliefs, and you're not going to lose your mind. You can if you're very methodical and you want to be careful, good. Be careful. Be methodical. Just change your beliefs a little bit at a time. Just open it up to say, what if it's possible that these reality shifts could be beneficial for me and that they are, in fact, helping make possible all life on Earth, which I believe they are, then that's the beginning. Good diet, good sleep. And I would further recommend reading about other people's experiences if possible. I publish a monthly newsletter, and I've been doing that since 1999, which was actually the first edition of that book, Reality Shifts, in a very early three-ring binder format, which later came out in other formats. But the first edition came out in 99, and the current edition is the 2011. But basically, if you just read a book like Reality Shifts or look at the website realityshifters.com, you don't have to subscribe to the newsletter. Every single issue is posted online. You can look at the most recent ones or browse topics that you're interested in. And each issue actually includes firsthand reports from people, including myself, describing these kinds of reality shifts. And when people start thinking about it, when they read the book, when they hear about these various stories, firsthand reports, and which can be considered a case history, if you will, of evidence for reality shifts from field scientists out there all around the world, then we start building up a basis for by which each of us can start expanding our ability to experience more of these.
Cynthia Sue Larson, you in your book, Reality Shifts, you were maybe unwittingly referencing the theories and behind-the-scenes physics of the Mandela effect. And how would you describe the Mandela effect, and what are your thoughts now on its popularity?
Yes. Well, that's a good... I love the question there, too. And because so many people now, and I'm getting phone calls from people, emails from people saying that they have never, ever entertained any so-called New Age ideas, which they would have previously relegated the topic of reality shifts to. These are serious scientists. They are people who consider themselves complete pragmatists, and that's why this is shocking to them. So the Mandela effect is a term that was coined by blogger Fiona Broom in 2010, and this was a time where she was hearing many people talking about and remembering the example of having heard that Nelson Mandela from South Africa had died many years before 2010. And they were surprised that Nelson Mandela was alive in 2010. And so this is the beginning of that Mandela effect. What Fiona Broom then did is created the format through her website, which then got picked up by sites such as Reddit and just all over the place, Twitter, Facebook, you name it. People started tweeting and posting about their own experiences with celebrities who had been dead and are now noticed alive again.
Mm-hmm.
This began the global conversation on the topic of alternate histories. in which things that we've been taught in school that can't change, such as human physiology, star constellations, global geography, historical events, movie dialogue, product names, logos, and movie scenes appear to be changing and not so permanent after all. And so I attribute the popularity of the Mandela effect right now largely to the relative ease with which people can find others who also remember similar alternate histories to the ones they do. Whereas previously, before the internet, before the website on the Mandela effect, I did have my Reality Shifters website, but somehow it wasn't quite getting picked up as much as the Fiona Broom site for whatever reason. And now, thanks to both of them and all these other sites popping up, more than quietly assuming that an individual must be misremembering something, people have another alternative. They recognize, well, maybe it's not me. It looks like there are lots of other people who remember the Ford logo is different, who remember movie dialogue from Star Wars being different, and so forth.
Cynthia, since you you referenced that, here's some common examples. The children's book series, The Berenstain Bears, is now The Berenstain Bears. The interesting thing about that is on Reddit, somebody posted a VHS cassette. On the surface of it was the label that read Berenstain Bears, S-T-A-I-N. However, on the spine, there was a sticker that read Berenstain. It was spelled S-T-E-I-N on the same VHS tape. Laurel and Hardy, this is another fine mess you've gotten us into is now. This is another fine mess you've gotten me into. The TV show Sex in the City is now Sex and the City. The Disney animation film Snow White, the line "Mirror, mirror on the wall" is now "Magic, mirror on the wall." In the Star Wars first film, the line by Darth Vader, "Luke, I am your father," is now, "No, I am your father." There's one that really bothers people for some reason. Mr. Rogers' opening song, it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, is now, "It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood." And that one in particular, didn't Eddie Murphy parody that in Saturday Night Live? And so I looked it up, and sure enough, Eddie Murphy comes out onto the set and sings that song, and he says, "It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, not this." So the parody is true to the initial memory that people have.
Well, that makes sense, though, because people, when they sing a song, if they remember that other reality, it's, you know, when you memorize the lyrics, it goes with the melody, and it just sounds weird if the words change.
Exactly. It doesn't quite fit. I noticed, too, that these examples are mainly Western consumer culture. What do you think's going on there?
Okay, well, this is where I'm really grateful that I've been collecting these firsthand case histories for so many years, decades really, and I've been picking them up from around the world, not just the West. So I do get reports from Asia, from the Soviet Union occasionally, from, you know, it's obviously the Eastern Bloc nations may not be so wired to the internet, but nevertheless, I think when you're looking at Mandela effects, we have a bias toward the West, so you're going to be seeing things that are tilted that direction. Fortunately, like I said, I've been getting some reports from other places, too. I do know that this must be a worldwide phenomenon based on the reports that I've been hearing. And I think it's really worth mentioning that so that people know that it's not just in the West, because that's just perhaps an artifact of the way that we're currently more likely to hear about people who are familiar with our culture. So people who are in other countries are hearing other stories. They're not hearing the products that we're familiar with or movie dialogue that we know, but instead products that they're familiar with and celebrities that they know who are not commonly recognized by us. And that's, in fact, the kind of stories that I've received from Reality Shift firsthand reports from around the world.
Well, that's great. But if a parallel reality was going to bleed in with ours, it would seem to have a bigger effect.
Well, I have had reports from some individuals over these last 20 years where they've written to me, and they are the outlier experiencers, where they definitely have experienced something on the scale of the Philadelphia experiment. In one case, and these people generally ask me, please don't share this story. This is horrific. I don't want to freak people out. You know, it was too horrible that I experienced it. It's just awful. In one case, so I'm not going to obviously mention who it was or when. I'm going to protect their identity that way. I'll just explain the generalities of two of these outlier data points from all these people showing me their firsthand reports all these years. One of them actually witnessed what he described to me, what sounded for all the world like a nuclear strike. He was situated at that time in Australia, and he witnessed changing in the color of the sky. He didn't use technical terms to describe what happened, but basically there was a power failure, and before that happened, the TV news reports were talking about, you know, possibility, there were broken down relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and it looked like it was on the verge of World War III. He was actually then witness to the sky changing color, there being some sort of electromagnetic pulse, which did knock out all of the power. And he described things having a very, very detailed description of the way things felt to him. He was terrified. And then shortly after this all happened, he just felt like, no, this can't be. And the next thing he realized, he was back in a reality as if he'd been daydreaming about it, but that was no daydream. And it just shook him to his core. So that was one example. Another individual wrote to me about having experienced being in a Nazi United States of America. This would be about 6-7 years ago, I guess. So we're now 2016. This is like 2010, Nazi America. So the coins, the flags, the buildings, everything, instead of being the currency that we're familiar with U.S. presidents, you know, it was very much, you know, it was Hitler pretty much everywhere. Other Nazi things we would call memorabilia was current. It was in the currency, the monetary, everything. And he was also shaken to his core, and it just felt like probably like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, you know, just wants to click your heels and be back home. It was horrific. So these are people, but that's rather rare. In most cases, and I've heard from a few others that had personally shocking experiences where it only affected them and their families. In one case, a man wanted to see his deceased son again, but the only reality that he could make that jump to ended up with him being paraplegic in a wheelchair with a wife who hated him. Their son was alive, but his life was trash. So, but that didn't affect the whole world. But I'm just describing some bizarre outliers. For the most part, people don't experience these things, and I can understand why that would be as well. You know, basically because we're entangled with our loved ones, or entangled with our family, our friends, our coworkers. That means it's like a safety net. It's like we're literally sharing our experience of reality with those closest to us. And we can bungee jump farther when you've got friends who are willing to be a little bit more open-minded, who are willing to experience a huge shift in your life where you might be able to go from, you know, horrific lifelong illness to something where it's instantaneously cured, that sort of thing. But you need to have support from a spiritual community, because people of faith, you know, tend to experience a lot more of the so-called placebo effect. They get something like a 70% advantage over those who don't believe in anything like that.
Yeah, this is an area of your book I find interesting, and that is almost taking conscious control of reality shift into a positive direction that could help. And some of the things that you mentioned about healing yourself are really interesting. And the reference to masters in other parts of the world, such as in the Philippines, who can heal people. What is happening on the quantum level with consciousness and the physical world when that happens?
Okay. Yeah, when healing is happening, you can look at it. The key to it, to making this kind of a conscious jump, and the reason faith works so well, is that it's really important that we start recognizing that we are not our physical body. So people of faith typically know that. That's usually part of a spiritual tradition, whatever it might be. And they would recognize to begin with that they are not their body, that they have a soul, that they are an eternal, infinite being. that is a fantastically supportive belief to have. It's a good one in order to be able to make a quantum jump or a reality shift, because what you're going to be doing is essentially, first of all, recognizing that you are pure consciousness. That's step one. And that as pure consciousness, you can basically be free. It's like when the observers in the experiment I described were watching a quantum particle blip in and out of existence, that little electron would show up in one place, vanish, and show up somewhere else. You can do that. You can jump from one reality to another. You can basically teleport from one reality to another. And you can do it by virtue of recognizing that you can be a wave form also. In the form of pure consciousness, you're not your material body. You are pure consciousness. And that can be the vehicle by which you travel. That soul, that spirit that you are, thus is capable of traveling to a reality in which you don't have cancer, you don't have an inoperable illness or ailment, and you can experience miraculous healing that basically there's no classical explanation, there's no theory to explain why the spontaneous remissions occur. However, with quantum jumps, with reality shifts, with understanding how this works, we start getting a mechanism by which the placebo effect can work and by which spontaneous remission, in fact, would be expected to occur. So step one, realize that you're pure consciousness. And step two, you're going to recognize that from that place of being pure consciousness, you've got a vantage point. You can see all the possible realities. And then you can lock on to either one that looks good to you or one that feels like the best possible reality. Just recognizing that this is accessible to you and that you can reach out to it and become that. And then the third step is just acting as if you're there. And people of faith find this whole process much easier because, number one, they know they've got a soul. Number two, they believe in God, so they can go to that awareness. Or it doesn't matter. It might not be God. It might be Allah. It might be oneness. Lots of names for this experience of ultimate goodness and consciousness. So the physicists that I was talking about earlier, they call it the census taker. You can be an atheist and still have this experience. It's really recognizing that there's this consciousness level that supersedes and is greater than anything that any human can ever possibly know, but that it does exist, it's real, it's there, and that you can join with it, you can merge with it, you can trust it to help guide you to a better place for you that's healthier, that this is the way nature works. You can remind yourself of that. And then that's step three. This is where people of faith have an advantage. They can act as if they're in the new reality. That means don't do things that put you back in jeopardy. So if you used to have lung cancer and now it's spontaneously in remission, I'd recommend don't start smoking again. You know, just act as if you've been cured. Do things. Maybe for you it is smoking cigarettes, but hopefully you're engaging in lower risk behavior. You know, doing things that are supportive of better health and doing things that are part of how you conceive that this jump happened. So if you have a certain faith, be a good person. You know, act in good faith toward others. It'll help to engage that part of your subconscious that then believes that you are worthy of being a recipient of such a miracle.
Well, you slammed your thumb or finger in the door, and you had to reach over and unlock the door. That happened to me. And however, the healing experience did not happen to me because I didn't really know about it. I was young at the time. But I would try that. Can you tell listeners what you did?
Yes. Okay. This goes back to the late 90s. I opened my car door, and I was driving the car, so it's the driver's side door. And I was reaching back for something. I think it was my purse. And so I had my left hand up on the door frame, and I don't think it occurred to me that in that position that the door might swing shut. I hadn't yet stepped out of the car, so I should explain that. I'm sitting in the driver's seat. I just have my hand outside the door. That was foolish in retrospect, but what happened, I guess you've experienced it too. It's horrible thing, horrible feeling. That's a metal car door. This is a very heavy car door, and it just slammed shut into the locked position, and my left index finger was trapped there. That's the big finger on my left hand. And I did not get out of the car quickly. It took, well, it seemed like it took forever. In real life, I guess it was several seconds before I realized, oh my gosh, look what happened. How do I get out of this? You know, there's just that fumbling moment where you're opening the door. That was enough so that my finger was in incredible pain. It was, in fact, I was not sure if it was broken or not. It felt mangled. And I looked at it, and it didn't look like it was broken or sprained, but it looked terrible. There was a huge indentation where the door had shut, and a bruise was starting. And my immediate thought was, great, you know, this is really going to mess my life up. Plus, I bruise really easily, so I thought this is going to be really messed up. So at that point in time, I'd been through a Reiki class, which is a formalized way of doing exactly what I just described. You don't necessarily need Reiki to get a Reiki result. It's the same thing I just described to you. You need to know that you are consciousness. You need to access that greatest, highest level of consciousness, and you need to act as if. But if you happen to use Reiki, then you've got at your fingertips. That's kind of funny with this example. Yes, you've got at your fingertips some symbology, because Reiki symbols are set up so that you can instantly visualize them, work with their energy, and with something like the Choku Rei symbol, instantaneously access the healing power. And so it helps you in a time of great pain and possible torment where it's hard to think clearly, because you've been working with these symbols, you remember them, you remember your entire physiology and your mind-body-spirit connection is all set up to harness that healing power instantly. So I was able to do that. I felt tremendous heat and energy intensifying in my finger, so it felt worse right away. And people who do Reiki know what I mean. Then after a couple of minutes, it felt normal again. When I uncovered my finger, because I'd wrapped it with my right hand, I saw no swelling, no bruises, and it looked identical to all the rest of my hand within like half an hour. So that's just, according to our Western medicine, that would be remarkable. And this sort of thing is documented in case histories of many, 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 many doctors and medical patients. Lots of people have had this experience. In fact, I bet you every listener out there either has had a similar experience or knows somebody who has. That's just how common this is. So maybe it didn't happen for you this time, and I'm sorry it didn't. But it does help if you can, in that moment, go through those steps. So it helps to have Reiki certification or have had a little bit of experience getting into this mind state, this little process of recognizing I am pure consciousness. I can connect to the highest level of all realities and access everything, including a healthy one.
This explanation is very important to learn about, because in the 1999 movie Contact with Jodie Foster, at the end they show her looking at a galaxy in space and reaching out and touching this galaxy as the fabric ripples out around her. And it's as if there's no space between where she is and the vast universe. And you talk about this. It's referencing our interconnectedness despite the vast distance. Is that something that connects here with understanding quantum physics and our consciousness?
Yes, and what a beautiful image that is. I love it. I that was such a significant movie. I think it was one of the all-time great films to show the possibility of extraterrestrial consciousness, even though it was a little unclear in the ending as to what exactly is going on. But the visual imagery was profound. Mm-hmm. And I also got that same feeling you're talking about, that you can literally reach through and touch something. And when you realize we're doing it all the time, in the movie we see Jodie Foster doing it, and it looks like, wow, that she's in an altered state. She's really special. That might never happen to me. At least those are the kind of things I was thinking. But with these reality shifts, it's extraordinary, because you start recognizing this could happen to me, and it's part of our everyday reality, but somehow we haven't noticed it. It's this profound experience of recognizing that all of reality as we know it, it's just this whole new concept that it could be an overlapping, a superposition of all possible realities. And at every given moment, how we think and what we're feeling, that puts us in the driver's seat as to where we're going next. I think I got that feeling in that movie Contact of that as well. So I think it's a phenomenal moment because with no words, so much was conveyed. Maybe that was just me, but I really got that feeling that it really depends on how you're thinking, what you're feeling, as to where you go with it.
Yeah, I thought about that decades later. I remembered the ending, and I thought, wait a minute, they're telling us something here. There's no distance.
Right.
Well, Cynthia Sue Larson, I want to say thank you very much for being on In Other News. This has been really interesting. Your book, Reality Shifts When Consciousness Changes the Physical World. I know it's an older book, and you've written more since then. Can you tell listeners how to reach you, and what are your other books?
Yes. Well, you can reach me best through my website, which is realityshifters.com. And through that portal, you can catch me on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, sign up for my newsletter. And you can also purchase autographed copies of my newest book, Quantum Jumps, An Extraordinary Science of Happiness and Prosperity, my book, High Energy Money, and my book, Aura Advantage, my book, Reality Shifts When Consciousness Changes the Physical World, that we've been talking about, also Karen Kimball, which is a young adult novel, and my meditation CD, Aura Healing Meditations.
Great. Well, Cynthia, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been delightful.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives of the show. Thank you.